The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Tony Graham
CeeLo
Local 35, I just want to say a few things about the union and what's bothering me about it.
All right. See, I woke everybody up. Now I will put you to sleep. Now, what I want to do is, I gave a talk 2 years ago about Gramsci, which basically went up to the prison notebooks. That is the point where he went into prison. Hello? Louder?
1926, before he went into prison. And what I want to do, I decided, I suppose I should do another talk, which says something about Gramsci and when he went into prison. He was a revolutionary who devoted his life to the creation of a mass workers' party that could overthrow the Italian capitalist state and replace it with a state based on workers' councils. And so, for example, he wrote in 1920, "The fundamental and indispensable condition for attempting any experiment with Soviets, that's workers' councils, is the existence of a cohesive and highly disciplined communist party that can coordinate and centralize the whole of the working class's revolutionary action in its central executive committee by means of its nuclei within the factories, unions, and cooperatives." He said that in 1920. Now, this is not the kind of writing that will get you friends in academia. And yet, paradoxically, Gramsci today is, if not the most widely read, is the most widely referenced Marxist in academia, and that's the paradox I want to say something about. This is not the Gramsci that, you know, the revolutionary Gramsci is not the one that has warmed the hearts of academics. It's his prison notebooks, that is the 33 notebooks, 10 which were translations that he was doing in prison, the other 23 writing on different topics, which consisted of individual fragments, sometimes a few sentences long, sometimes several pages, to take up a myriad of topics from the development of Italian intellectuals, the Italy during the city-states, literature, popular literature, the question of the party, which he calls the modern prince. He basically wrote notes on statistics on Italian finance in the late 1920s. I mean, if you look through the notebooks, it's just got all kinds of notes on all kinds of things that he was reading about and studying at the time. Fundamental to creating the academically appropriated Gramsci was separating the revolutionary Gramsci from the Gramsci of the prison notebooks. And that was easy to do for a number of reasons. One is because Gramsci himself became separated from active revolutionary life by going into prison. And the very method by which he was forced in prison to write the notebooks imparts to them, as I said, a fragmentary character. And because of the conditions of prison censorship and the difficulties related to developments of Stalinism, he uses a lot of coded language. And then in the midst of using coded language, he's also trying to explore concepts in different ways. That is, things he's been thinking out about but hasn't been able to develop when he was an active revolutionary. So on one level, you could say the positive side is he never had time to study and write. The negative side is he was a person who was essentially slowly dying in prison with really knew he had very little time left. I would say it was like a dying body with a brain like a flickering candle flame, trying to get put down on paper and study and do something that could be valuable for future Marxists. Now, which is what frustrates revolutionaries when they read Gramsci, but which excites and delights academics. And that's really, I think, one way to understand it. And in fact, it was the Italian Communist Party, the Stalinized Italian Communist Party, which at first turned its back on Gramsci, after he died, several years after his death and after the war, began to republish Gramsci, who actually were the ones who initially created this separation between the Gramsci of the scholar. They published the notebooks and they pretty much wanted to present Gramsci as this premier Italian scholar, great intellectual, along with Benedetto Croce and these other Italian scholars. That is, it was part of an operation by the Italian Communist Party to present the party as a party that's part of Italian politics and the Italian nation, and therefore deserves to be in a coalition government with the Christian Democrats. That is, it was all about creating an academic Gramsci which could back up the idea of a reformist Stalinist party which wanted to collaborate in power with the Christian Democrats. That's where it begins, and then it really goes haywire in, I'm gonna have to pay some attention to what I've written here. It goes haywire in the late 60s, where there's a kind of reemergence, a reflowering of interesting Gramsci. It really in the 70s, again, first promoted by the Italian Communist Party, which is trying to distance itself from the Soviet Union, and so again uses Gramsci and what Gramsci writes in the notebooks to try to present an Italian Communist Party as independent, with its own independent thought, its own intellectuals that could be independent of any kind of taint of the Soviet Union, and for the same reasons, because they wanted to have a historic compromise. That is, they wanted to be in coalition government with the Christian Democrats. That then becomes, really takes off academically around the world, and I'm not going to really go through all that except to say that that's really the point where Gramsci's ideas about hegemony and various other things become part of the panoply of sort of academic studies and left academic studies, whether it's, you know, subaltern studies in India to linguistic theory, to literary criticism, international relations. I mean, I can't cover it all because I haven't studied all those things, but apparently Gramsci is in all those things. And really, he became a sort of poster boy or a stepping stone to something called post-Marxism, which took Gramsci's idea of hegemony, which is really about how does the working class create around it a kind of, how does it become the leader of the whole society to transform society? To the idea of hegemony being any group, subordinate group within society confronting the hegemony of the group that's opposing it, there's no center, there's no working class agency, that working class is not at the center of a project to change society. It's really multiple hegemonies competing against each other on a plane of various different social movements and struggles. And that really, in other words, really a move away, Gramsci was used as a way to move away from Marxism. And I'll just give you one quote. Wait, can I give you one quote? Yeah, I think I can give you one quote from Laclau and Mouffe, who wrote a book called Hegemony and Social Strategy, which, you know, really has nothing to do with what Gramsci says in the notebooks in many ways, but let's just quote them so you get an idea. The important point is that every form of power is constructed in a pragmatic way, and internally to the social, through the opposed logics of equivalence and difference. Power is never foundational. The problem of power cannot, therefore, be posed in terms of the search for the class or the dominant sector, which constitutes the center of a hegemonic formation. We got hegemony in there. Given that, by definition, such a center will always elude us. Translation, the working class is not at the center of a revolutionary project to change society. Multiple social movements are, and their purpose is to fight for liberal democracy, not socialism. And that really, that's just an example of the misuse or the abuse, because I really want to spend most of my talk, even though it's called Use and Abuse of Gramsci, talking about the abuse of Gramsci, because that's not really particularly useful for us. In reality, what Gramsci is committed to in the notebooks is defending and elaborating Marxism as best he could under very difficult circumstances. I was going to do a brief biography of Gramsci before he goes into prison. I really don't think I'm going to have time, so all I'm going to really emphasize is that Gramsci was a revolutionary, born in Sardinia, studied in Turin, became closely connected to the factory movement in Turin in the 1919 to 1920, published a newspaper which is very famous now, L'Ordine Nuovo, New Order, which closely worked with the labor movement at the time and developed the idea that these factory organizations called the Internal Commissions could become the foundation of a factory council movement in Italy, which could, like Russia, unite nationally and become the basis of workers' power. In the process, he became very critical of the Socialist Party because it was clear to him that the Socialist Party was rhetorically radical and revolutionary, but practically reformist and passive. And so there was a revolutionary situation in 1919 to 1920, which never came to fruition, was defeated, one, because the main leaders of the Socialist Party refused to support the Factory Council movement or it spread to other cities, and refused to lead a revolutionary movement. That is, was trapped within the reformist framework of in Italy and rhetorically whipped up the masses in struggle, but then refused to organize and take leadership over that movement in a revolutionary way. Trapped, Gramsci then becomes with other leaders of the Socialist Party, left-wingers, helps form the Communist Party in 1920 under inauspicious circumstances. That is, it's a party of, which begins with the rise of fascism, which develops to crush the workers' movement. It's a mass movement of the petty bourgeoisie that physically smashes the labor movement and the organizations and institutions of the working class. So this is the period in which Gramsci becomes a communist, at a certain point becomes a leader of the Communist Party. The party begins as an ultra-left party, which refuses to have anything to do with anything to its right, that is any reformist workers' organizations, because it believes that it has to remain pure so that when the revolutionary moment arrives, it can lead the masses. So it's a sectarian organization that doesn't involve itself in the day-to-day struggles of the working class. Gramsci, with help from the Comintern, from the Communist International, rearms the party, reorients it, and becomes the leader of that party, and then almost immediately is imprisoned. The reason I say that is just so you have some sense of our starting point. So he's arrested on November 8th, 1926. And he's supposed to have immunity because he's a deputy in the parliament, but he doesn't have it. Mussolini is already in power. He's been since 1922. He's consolidated his power. By 1926, he's fully in control, and he starts going after the left, smashing the Communist Party. So he goes on trial. He's sentenced to over 20 years, and the prosecutor at his trial says, "We have to stop this brain from functioning for 20 years," which he doesn't fully succeed in doing. And in prison, essentially what happens to him is he was always ill throughout his life. He had problems with nervous illness, various kinds of illnesses. He developed a hunchback when he was young. There are different possible reasons for that. He was very frail. When he gets into prison, almost immediately his health begins to deteriorate. And I just want to give you a sense of that. Where am I talking about his health? Give you a sense. When he arrived in Turi, which was the prison he ended up in after a couple years, it was the prison where he spent about 5 years and where he basically, his life kind of ran down. He was already suffering from nervous exhaustion, he was losing his teeth, he had trouble breathing, he had digestive problems, he had urinary disorder, he had trouble walking without someone helping him. He had ups and downs, but his health deteriorated over time. He had chronic insomnia. He had headaches that were so painful he would bang his head against the wall. He writes a note to Titania, which is a woman he wrote to a lot, who helped him. He was a sister-in-law whose wife lived in Russia with his two kids. But she helped him a lot, along with another left-wing intellectual named Piero Sraffa, who helped him get books in prison. But essentially he wrote her a note saying, "I get about just under 2 hours of sleep every night." So just give you a sense, if you sustain it over a long period of time, you can't survive. So in a certain sense, he gets permission to write notes early 1929. And in a sense, his desire to read and write was a lifeline, something to keep him from sinking into despair and lethargy, but also something that he wanted to do that he thought would be useful for the international movement. And so, as I said, he writes these 33 notebooks, some of them translations, the rest notes on things that he's read and his thoughts, and he writes on, it's ridiculous. The Risorgimento in Italy, the formation of intellectuals, Dante's Inferno, Machiavelli, popular literature, the place of Benedetto Croce in Italy, the study of philosophy, popular literature, types of periodicals, base and superstructure, materialism, idealism. It just goes on and on and on, and then some of them are just weird, you're like, shipping losses of Italy during World War I, you know, long note with tonnage listed. You're like, what? Why? You know, clearly, it's just to keep his mind exercised. You know, it's like, oh, wait till an academic gets their hands on that note, you know. In the end, his health just breaks down, and he ends up, pressure from the outside gets him in a clinic in 1935, but he's still in prison. He can't leave it, and finally dies in a clinic in Rome just after he gets out in 1937. So essentially, he has this active mental life while he's dying, which is about five, six, 7 years, and then the last 2 or 3 years, he's essentially can't even write, except maybe a few letters, and he dies. I think it's important, before I start talking about the content of the notebooks, to understand the character of the notes, not just the fragmentary character, but his own cautionary notes within the notes about what he's writing. He says, for example, in notebook 4, in general, remember that all these notes are provisional and written as they flow from the pen. They must be reviewed and checked in detail because they undoubtedly contain imprecisions, anachronisms, wrong approaches, etc., that do not imply wrongdoing because the notes are solely the function of quick memorandum. That's his own note about the notes that he's writing, which, you know, rarely is recognized by people who write about Gramsci's notes, in prison. And then he says, a work can never be identified with the raw material collected for its compilation. It is the definitive choice, the way the component elements are arranged, the greater or lesser importance given to this or that element of those collected in the preparatory phase, which are precisely what constitutes the effective work. So that those two things together, I think, are really important warning signs that there's a difficulty in talking about the notebooks because you have to be interpretive. You have to figure out what the hell he's saying. But at the same time, he's giving us a warning, which is very important, which is, you know, you may not completely figure out what I'm saying because I haven't figured out what I'm saying. You know, in some cases, I'm positing hypotheses and ideas and thoughts. So don't take this and turn it into some well worked out, set of ideas that all connect together. Now, having said that, unfortunately, there's a certain way in which if you're going to get any value out of the notebooks, that you have to try to do that. So that's a little, I don't know, two-faced, but. That's the problem, I think, in many ways of the prison notebook. Now there, I talked about the question of prison censorship, and I know there is, for example, in Peter Thomas's book, he tries to show that there's a lot of concepts developed in the notebooks that have nothing to do with prison censorship. That's true. I think that there are some concepts that Gramsci develops that go beyond. Just terminological, trying to hide what he's saying. But there's no question that in a lot of ways he's still trying to either disguise what he's saying from the fascists or from the Communist International. That is, in 1929, he has a series of arguments in prison with his fellow prisoners, and most of them shun him because he disagrees with the Stalinist third period. That is the period in which turns actually, in some ways, back towards the Bordiga's position that I described at the beginning, and a party that stands above and outside a struggle and denounces anything to its right, it refuses to unite with it against fascism because all the parties to its right are in some way connected to capital, bourgeois rule, and fascism. And so it becomes a kind of isolationist position, and that's what the third period was. It was this ultra-left denouncing all reformist working class organizations as social fascists, and therefore we will not unite with them, and that there's an immediate path to socialism, which involves the party just calling up the insurrection. That's kind of the logic of the third period. He goes against that completely and is isolated and shunned. So there's also that complication. It's pretty clear, not clear, but it seems to be the case that in his notebooks, there are veiled criticisms, which I'll quote one of them, of the Soviet Union and its direction, but there is no, and this is also one of the paradoxes of Gramsci in his notebooks, there's no open coming to terms with of Stalinism. There's no systematic coming to terms with that. That was done by Trotsky and his followers. He didn't do that. In fact, when he went into prison, he went against the Trotskyist opposition. He was critical of the Soviet Union. In fact, the way that he supported, the way that he opposed the opposition did not make the Stalinists happy because he did it equivocally and critically. And I don't have time to go in that, but it has to be said in looking at the notebooks that Gramsci, one of the weaknesses of them is that he doesn't, make some kind of a decision, whatever, because of what he thinks politically, I don't know. He doesn't decide, maybe because his wife lived in Russia, that's another consideration which I don't think I've read anyone ever considered, but the guy's wife and kids live in Russia. And so, you think about it at the time, you know, early 1930s, gee, I think I'll say something critical about Stalin. Can't, my wife's in Russia. You know, I mean, if anybody knows anything about what was happening in Russia at the time, that would be, I think, a pretty strong consideration. So those things, I think, in terms of setting things up is really important. But before I go into the notes, I want to read one note just to give you a sense of the cryptic way that he writes and why these things are so difficult to read. This is from Notebook 7, Note 2. Translatability of scientific and philosophical languages. That sounds pretty academic. In 1921, Organizational Issues, Velici said and wrote, "We have not been able to translate our language into the European languages." Does anybody know what that means? It's about linguistics, right? No, it's not about linguistics. It's about the Third Congress of the Communist International, where the party rules of party organization that were written, Lenin denounces as being too Russian. That is, the other parties won't be able to understand what we're saying because they don't understand the Russian experience. And so we can't translate our political experience in Russia as a party and our revolutionary experience into languages that the other revolutionary parties can understand. Didn't you get that from reading that note?
I did.
The point is, if anybody who's a revolutionary who knows anything about the Comintern at the time would know immediately that 1921 in Velici has to be Lenin, Ilyich, and the Comintern. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of academics who read that don't even know what the reference is. So that's just to give you a sense. So I want to go over some of the basic ideas with the caveat that I explain. Some of the things that are in the notebook. I obviously can't go through everything because I myself don't understand a lot of what he's talking about because it's in fields that I don't follow and because it involves history, which I haven't studied. And so this is not really about everything Gramsci said in the notebooks. I'm trying to tease out, following a number of books and authors that I've read and some of the direct reading that I've done on the selections of the prison notebooks and the three volumes of the six or seven that have been translated into English. I didn't read everything. I skipped all the stuff on literature, for example. But anyway, I want to just tease out things like what is his concept of hegemony, of the state, of the what he calls the modern prince, the revolutionary party, the formation of intellectuals, and so on. And I apologize for only being able to give you some taste of what it is that Gramsci's talking about. It's clear, though, that his pre-prison, what he writes in prison is based on things that he was considering outside of prison. So, for example, the last thing he writes in before he goes into prison is something called Some Aspects of the Southern Question, which he talks about really in parallel to the Russian question, how it is that the only basis on which the Italian working class can become a leading revolutionary force has to be in unity with the South, that is the peasantry of the South, and therefore the land question has to be connected to the labor question for there to be a political, for the working class to be able to become, to form a political party that gives a lead to the whole of Italian society against capitalism, all of the oppressed classes in Italy. And that was in the history of the movement at the time, really what the concept of hegemony was. It goes back to the Russian revolutionary movement. It was used by Plekhanov, it was used by Axelrod, and later by Lenin, to talk about the leadership of the working class in the movement against Tsarism, leading and allying with other classes, in particular for Lenin, the peasantry, in order to challenge the Tsarist state. And against, and this is really where what is to be done was very important for Gramsci, against economism, against the idea that the work, or what Gramsci calls economic corporatism, which is the idea that the working class should limit its struggle to purely economic demands that would either automatically, because of, you know, the inevitable course of capitalist development, lead to socialism, or as Lenin argued, that political approach would end up subordinating the working class to other class forces because it would limit itself to its purely economic corporative interests. And so that's a really important feature of all through the notebooks is the idea of how does the working class How is it possible for the working class to move from a purely economic sense of itself as a class to a political and social sense of itself as a class that can lead others in a struggle to overturn capitalism? That is a really important concern, and it's a concern which comes from the experience, the Russian experience. All right, I can move up on some of this stuff. And Gramsci himself, for example, says, let me just quote Trotsky, because I'm, I gotta go back. The first thing I wanna talk about then, actually, I'm gonna come back to hegemony, is this concept of East versus West. And this was something which was also debated in the Comintern and talked about in the Comintern. Trotsky, for example, introduces the idea, and Lenin does as well, that it was easy in Russia to make the revolution because the state sort of dominated society and ruled mostly through coercion. And quote-unquote civil society, or the you know, organizations of schools, universities, the press, the bourgeoisie itself was very weak. And so it was easy to make a revolution in Russia, more difficult to complete it. That is, once we had power, the difficulties begin because of the low economic development and cultural development of Russia, unless the revolution spreads. And then, but the argument was always in the West, it will be reversed. The bourgeoisie is much stronger in the West. It has many more institutions, not just the coercive state. It has hegemony. It has control of, it has, it can appeal to a whole, he uses military terms, a whole, series of trenches and outworks, ideological, organizational, institutional, to defend the system. And really coercion or the use of force is something that they can hold in the background while these other things work to cement the subordinate classes in society to the rule of the bourgeoisie. And so therefore, revolution in the West will be much more protracted, difficult, and involve a much longer period of struggle. But if the working class is able to take power in the West, the period after the revolution will be much easier because capitalism is so much more developed in the West, because culturally, socially, there's been, technologically, it's much more developed. So that argument was out there, and that was really an argument that influenced directly Gramsci in prison. So he says in the prison notebooks, in the East, the state was everything. Civil society was primordial and gelatinous. In the West, there was a proper relationship between state and civil society. And when the state trembled, a sturdy structure of civil society was at once revealed. The state was only an outer ditch, and behind which there was a powerful system of fortresses and earthworks. So using military terminology, but that's sort of analogies, but that's... And so for Gramsci argued, what we need in the West is not a war of maneuver, which he defines as a direct assault on power, but a war of position. What he means by that is a kind of trench warfare, in which you dig in for the long haul. These analogies, I think, are problematic in a lot of ways because, you know, you start getting to, trench warfare worked in, they did it in World War I, but then in World War II, the invention of the tank destroyed trench warfare and, it became a war of maneuver again. Remember the Blitzkrieg? So, watch out for analogies, but the point still is what he's trying to get at is the idea that if there's a much more protracted period of struggle. And in fact, he directly links the question of a war of position in the West, or in the more, what he really means, the more advanced industrial countries, in particular the bourgeois democracies in Europe and the United States, to the idea of the United Front, which in the Comintern was the idea that, which was a very tactical, was debated in a kind of provisional tactical way. That is, they said, there's been this revolutionary wave in Europe, the wave is receding, the bourgeoisie is reconsolidating its power in the early 1920s throughout Europe. Communist parties are mass parties, but they do not have the allegiance of the majority of the working class. The majority of the working class in this country still hold their allegiance to the reformist socialist parties from which the communist parties had split for their betrayal of the revolution, their support for the imperialist war. So the question then they raised was, if we don't have a majority, and if the movement at this point is defensive, then it's about how to reunite the working class on a revolutionary basis. The only way to do that is to propose united actions with reformist working class organizations for the purposes of defending its organizations and its institutions, and only on that basis, and particularly against fascism, but also against against the bourgeoisie in general, could be for immediate economic demands as well, only on that basis could you win over the majority of the working class away from their allegiance to reformist organizations and to support the
Communist Party, because it's presenting itself as the uniter of the working class around the purposes of struggle that, that interests and involves the entire working class. So that was really the idea of the United Front. Gramsci says, for me, the United Front isn't just a tactical question, it's strategic, and it's about the whole strategic orientation of the Western Communist Parties. Now, we have to understand that, and that's what I mean by war position. He doesn't say it that way, because it's written like the note that I read to you, that I just read you. And so he says, the massive structure of the modern democracies, both as state organizations and as complexes of associations in civil society, that is traditionally what we consider as non-state organizations, are for the art of politics what trenches and permanent fortifications of the front are for the war of position. Part of his emphasis is the idea that part of the reason he emphasizes war of position is that he wants to emphasize the idea that the class, that there has to be a thorough political winning over of whole sections of society to a new way of conceiving and building a new kind of society. That there had to be a relationship between the struggle and also an ideological struggle, and that, you know, for hegemony within society. That is countering, sort of a counter hegemony to the political and ideological leadership or domination that the ruling class has in society. That's a big concern of his writings. Of course, the contradiction is that through the notes he criticizes Trotsky and associates him with the theory of the offensive, which is, I'm not going to go into, it was Gramsci himself knew was not the case. It was Trotsky who convinced Gramsci that the Italian party had to accept the United Front method. It was Trotsky who made the speech about the West versus the East. It was Trotsky who opposed the theory of the offensive in Germany in 1923 against the idea that you could just have a direct assault on power by a minority communist party. He was against all those things, so that's part of the confusion of reading the notes. It's like, he knows full well that that isn't true. Why is he saying it? And some people think that he's trying to throw off the track. In other words, while he's doing some things that are vaguely critical of Stalinism, he's throwing in sort of, he's lobbing in curveballs which are critical of Trotsky. That's one theory. It's actually just a theory because it's very difficult to figure out why. And one of the things I want to say about this idea about the East and West and the concept of the state is that the vagueness of the terms make it difficult to, like I said, to figure out exactly what he's saying, because he doesn't really go into detail. So what exactly is a war of position and war of maneuver is not always easy to figure out. And Gramsci himself says, comparison between military art and politics, if made, should always be taken with a grain of salt, which is what he writes in the notes. But I think it's clear, and there are people who have, obviously, as I said, like the Italian Communist Party, who use those ideas to draw reformist conclusions. In Russia, revolution. In the West, reform. In Russia, a direct assault on power. In the West, a slow, gradual accumulation of power through electing people into office and, you know, having our own cultural institutions and blah, 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 will create the counter-hegemony and to take over society. So it was used to draw reformist conclusions. Gramsci is clear, if you read him carefully, is not saying that he's now become a reformist and that that's how you achieve socialism in the West. He talks, for example, of how when the ruling class relies on the apparatus of state coercive power, which legally enforces discipline on those groups who do not consent, either actively or passively. This apparatus is, however, constituted for the whole of society in anticipation of moments of crisis of command and direction when spontaneous consent has failed. So it's pretty clear that Gramsci's not ignoring or saying that the state or that ruling class only rules sort of ideologically, that it has instruments of coercion. That's still the essence of what the state is, and that's how it maintains its power. And so he's actually adapting war of position, not as an alternative to the Russian experience, but from the Russian experience. That's why he links it to the United Front, which was used in Russia. In fact, in the debates, in the Comintern, against the ultra-leftists, the people who said, we don't need to work in the trade unions, we don't need to work in elections, we don't need to do any of those things, all we need is a direct assault on power. Lenin wrote Leveling Communism and Infantile Disorder, and in a debate with Italians, the Italians who were opposed to the idea that there should be any compromises, he said, You don't understand our history in Russia. Our party never had a direct assault on power. We had to unite, form a united front to defeat Kornilov, the right-wing coup. We proposed alliances with other parties. We linked up with the peasantry and supported land reform. And we waited until we had a majority in the Soviets to call out the insurrection. So those are all lessons that revolutionaries in the West learn. And Gramsci is not splitting himself off from that. He's basing himself on that. And so he says, he states in the notebook, the war of maneuver doesn't disappear. It becomes, quote, reduced to more of a tactical than a strategic function. So he's saying, really, ultimately, at some point, when you had a war of position in the West, at some point, it's going to lead to a point of confrontation in which power decides who's going to run society. And so I want to come back to the question of hegemony again. As I said, it's closely linked to the Russian experience. I already went through that, so that's good. And then he says in the notebook, this is the way he talks about hegemony. He says, a class is dominant in two ways. Namely, it is leading and dominant. It leads the allied classes. It dominates the opposing classes. Therefore, a class can and must lead even before assuming power. When it is in power, it becomes dominant, but it also continues to lead. There can and must be a political hegemony even before assuming governmental power, and in order to exercise political leadership or hegemony, one must not count solely on the power and material force that is given by government. So what he's doing is he's trying to link to the concept of hegemony, which is political leadership and leading other forces in alliance with them and having kind of ideological cachet, or however you want to put it, and the exercise of dominance, which involves coercion and force. That's his interest, both in terms of how states rule, but also how revolutionary movements develop, how classes can come to power. Those are his two concerns. So he's saying, in struggle for power, the working class must win the support of its allies in struggle. That's what he means by lead. And struggle for the domination over coercion of those classes it seeks to overthrow. That's really what he's saying. And that once it comes into power, it still has to exercise that leadership role in alliance with other forces in order to maintain its position of newly found position of power, but it also has to still exercise coercion against those classes which are still trying to claw back power. So that's, again, I think a really obvious example of where tragedy. But you can't really conclude that he's a reformist or that he's drawing reformist conclusions. And then he says, the normal exercise of hegemony on the now classic terrain of the parliamentary regime is characterized by a combination of force and consent, which balance each other so that force does not overwhelm consent, but rather appears to be backed by the consent of the majority expressed by the so-called organs of public opinion, which in certain situations, therefore, are artificially multiplied. So you can see he's trying to link and connect the questions of coercion and hegemony, coercion and legitimacy, and coercion and force and consent. I'm not going to go into that. And then he says at one point, what he essentially does, some people call it his concept of an expanded state, but he's more expansive than the way he looks at the state. He says, look, yes, the core of the state is bodies of armed men, prisons, etc. That's the foundation on which the ruling class maintains its rule. But it can't do it solely on that basis. Any state which relies only on coercion is a state in crisis. And therefore, we have to actually come to understand what are the means by which a ruling class, using not only the sort of core of those state institutions to maintain its domination. And so he talks about the state in some places as political society plus civil society. That is, hegemony protected by the armor of coercion. That's one of the ways that he looks at it. And so I think, though, it's important to understand, however, that this is not a theory of how the working class is permanently hoodwinked. This is not a theory of how is it that, you know, why. It's much more dynamic than that. He's trying to explain something that's a dynamic process that can have points of equilibrium, which is continually being upset. Counter-hegemonies, that is, the ruling class uses the state and various other institutions in society to cement its control. But it never is fully successful in doing that. It doesn't cement its control, because cement implies we can't move anymore. But what it does is it tries to do that, and in the process there is counter-hegemony and possibilities for subordinate classes to present a counter-program which is both ideological and, you know, about and transformative, about how to take what exists in society and change it in a certain way. So what he's really saying is, for example, the way he looks at how the ruling class rules, he uses sometimes this term passive revolution. And what he means by that, he's trying to use terms that are active. Passive revolution, he considers, for example, the way the bourgeoisie came to power in places like Italy and Germany, where there was no French-style revolution, there was no mass upheaval from below, led by elements of the bourgeoisie. Instead, you had the consolidation of bourgeois rule through actually power exercised initially by other classes, like the Junkers, the landowning class in Germany, in which the state became the kind of organizer of German capitalism. And so he tries to talk about passive revolution as a way of saying there are ways in which the ruling class has to actively and historically assert its own rule. It's not just an established passive fact. The ruling class is ruling, it feels that way, but it's actually something it has to continually try to do because of the class struggle, because it produces opposing interests and forces. And so passive revolution is also a way to understand how the ruling class, through the series of crises that it goes through periodically, maintains in some form or other its ability to rule and continue the existence of capitalist society. So, for example, to the extent that the ruling class is able to disperse and disorganize counter-hegemonic projects, it can rule even if it doesn't have complete consent. You know, that is, like, that's what fascism is. Fascism is not founded, contrary to what we learn about German fascism, it isn't because all the German people thought fascism was wonderful and accepted it. It was a project which was both political and coercive, in which the petty bourgeoisie was organized as a battering ram to smash working class organization. It was able to do that because the Communist Party was unable, even though it was a mass party, to provide an alternative. It refused to organize a united front against the fascists. So these are dynamic class questions, social questions. They're not fixed. It's not about, you know, it's not like, you know, you go to a, I don't know, communications class or something, and it's all about how everybody's hoodwinked by capitalism. You know, and it's just a completely, it's meant, you're meant to leave that classroom and go, God, people are so stupid and fucked up. But that's not what Gramsci's trying to do. He's trying to show how there's a dynamic process going on. And so the next thing I want to talk about a couple more things, is base and superstructure, because I think that question helps to understand why when Gramsci talks about hegemony, he's not being an idealist. All right, he's not being an idealist. He's talking about things that are connected to the social structure of society. So he calls the question of Bayesian superstructure the crucial problem of historical materialism. And what he does is he translates two things by Marx. I'm running out of time. He translates two things. He translates the preface to A Critique of Political Economy and a thing called the thesis on Feuerbach. And he constantly refers back to them. And what does the preface say? The preface says, the historical material view of society is that there are certain social relations that form for people to produce their own subsistence, but that produces a set of social relations which constitute the structure of society. But then upon that structure arises a superstructure of institutions, the state, the family, ideology, and so on, in which people become conscious of those relations and then fight out their conflicts. That's kind of the relationship that Marx talks about in Basis Superstructure. But then in the thesis on Feuerbach, Marx says the crude materialist conception that changed circumstances lead to changed people is one-sided, because it forgets that people are the ones who change circumstances. And so that if you have a one-sided crude materialist understanding, then what you're really saying is that what happens in the superstructure is a passive reflection of what happens in the base, what happens in the economic system. So the reason Gramsci puts those two things together is he's saying, yes, you have to understand the structures of society to understand how these superstructures, the state, ideas, parties, and so on, act and behave, but it's not a passive reflection. They're not just appearances that based on the base, that's actually the terrain on which the conflict is fought out. In fact, if that wasn't true, we could never have a successful revolution. Because what is a revolution? It's the point at which the superstructure dominates the base. It's the point at which the level of the development of the productive forces makes socialism possible, but it's at the level of the superstructure, that is, of political parties and struggle, that it becomes possible to take, to reorganize society from the top down and reorganize the productive relations in society as well. So there has to be a reciprocal relationship. There can't be a passive one. Otherwise, revolution is an impossibility. That's why, for Gramsci, the question of base and superstructure is so important. Oh man, this just pisses me off. But I hope I'm not putting people to sleep. It's just that. And so how does he apply it? For example, he talks about this question of prediction. He has several things where he talks about prediction. He says, look, the traditional way of looking at prediction is you just look at everything in society and you figure out where all the billiard balls are, and then you say, oh, see, that billiard ball is going to hit that billiard ball, that one's going to hit that one, and then it's going to go into that pocket. That's my prediction. Right? And he says that's a passive conception of prediction. Prediction, he says there are certain things in society you can understand by understanding the economic and social relations of society at the base. But once you understand that, there are all kinds of things that are contingent and accidental, that are not independent of what happens at the base. It's the only basis on which you can understand it, but are not just things that happen passively or are inexorably because a certain set of billiard balls have been set into motion, because he says it forgets that the people who are making predictions are themselves actors in the world, unless, of course, they're academics. You know, this is not an attack on our academics, because they're revolutionaries, but you know what I'm saying. Okay, so here's what he says. He says, in reality, one can scientifically foresee only the struggle. That is, the only thing we know for sure is that there will be class struggle under capitalism. We don't know its outcome. He says, but not the concrete moments of the struggle, which cannot be but be the results of opposing forces in continuous movement, which are never reducible to fixed quantities, since within them, quantity is continuing becoming quality. In reality, one can foresee to the extent that one acts, to the extent that one applies a voluntary effort and therefore contributes concretely to creating the result foreseen. So what he's saying is, he's not saying, you know, you have a certain set of ideas and you go and you set out to do it, you can make it happen. That's not what he's saying. In fact, he says, you can have utopian ideas, that is, ideas that are foolish and stupid because they have no relationship to reality. And in that sense, you're not really foreseeing anything. But he's also saying it's not a passive question. It's something that involves active intervention. I have a lot more I want to say, but I ran out of time. So really what I wanted to finish with is, really, that's how Gramsci talks about the question of the party. He basically says the question of the party is it's not a passive question. It's not about a political organization that stands and waits for the right moment and then kind of gives history a little bit of a shove. It has to be actively engaged. So it has to be a mass party. It can't be bureaucratic. And he has all kinds of arguments about bureaucracy and so on. And it can't be quote unquote economist. That is, the idea that, you know, the economic development of society and the class struggle will automatically lead to X, Y, and Z, because that's also passive. So ultra-leftism is passive, so is reformism. They're both based on a passive conception of the party and a political organization. What he wants to put forward is the idea of the party as an active transformer of society. And in the context of that, he emphasizes democratic centralism, democratic thrust from below combined with leadership from above, because it's only on that basis that you can have an organization which is attuned to struggles in society, and it's only on that basis that you could have real hegemony. That is, that you could educate and develop politically the consciousness and confidence of the working class to become a leader of the whole society. So those are all elements that come back to the question of hegemony. And I just want to finish, I want to read a quote about organic versus democratic centralism, and then I'll finish. He says, organicity can only be found in democratic centralism, which is, so to speak, a centralism in movement, i.e., a continual adaptation of the organization to the real movement, a matching of thrust from below with orders from above, a continuous insertion of elements thrown up from the depths of the rank and file into the solid framework of the leadership apparatus, which ensures continuity and the regular accumulation of experience. Democratic centralism is organic because, on the one hand, it takes account of movement, which is the organic mode in which historical reality reveals itself. And it doesn't solidify mechanically into bureaucracy. And because at the same time, it takes account of that which is relatively stable and permanent. That is, it takes into account both what is the necessity of having a certain stability of organization and the importance of being able to improvise and understand that the struggle flows and changes quickly. And that's really the real challenge of a revolutionary party, and that's why it can't scorn spontaneous movements, which he argues actually there's no such thing as spontaneity, which I can't go into, unfortunately. And, but that it's about relating to the rudimentary forms of struggle of the working class in order to move it first to the level of the working class is able, well, like Lenin says, is capable on its own of achieving economic class consciousness. But it has to have a revolutionary party, it has to have a political organization to achieve a consciousness which is not economic corporative. That is, goes beyond the concept of itself economically as a class and opposed to capital, and sees itself as a class that can lead other social forces into a total transformation of society. That's really how the question of the state, hegemony, the base, and the party all come together. Even though he was never able to kind of put it together like that, I think that's really, really what he's saying. And I have a few other things that I want to talk about, but I think I can do it in the course of the discussion. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.